convened this afternoon to hear but one case. And that is, and I may say this wrong, Vagnuer, is that close? Okay, versus the City of Aspen. Our case number 2000-HCA-2552. Matter has been set for oral argument for 15 minutes per side. I think probably everybody that's arguing today has done so before, but on the outside chance, you haven't. And have all of you come all the way from Aspen? No, one team is from Denver. Okay. The argument is set for 15 minutes per side. There's a digital timer system that keeps track of the time. There is a light system that's green the first 10 minutes, yellow for the next 5 minutes, and red when the argument's over. It is on the lectern as well as up here. There's also a reverse countdown clock that will keep you constantly posted as to how much time you have left. If the appellant wants to reserve time for rebuttal and wants me to assist in any way, I'll be happy to do so. I'll give you a high sign or signal, and you'll know when you have whatever time you want to reserve left. The time is limited. You may use the time any way you wish. I would like you to know that we have read the briefs. We've read some of the authorities cited in the briefs. We've even written some of the authorities cited in the briefs. So you may use your time any way you wish, but I would respectfully recommend that you go directly to the legal issues involved and not dwell a great deal on the facts. The lectern is equipped with a microphone. We record the arguments. It's a digital recording. It's on the internet within a day or two after the argument. So we appreciate your staying near the lectern so that the microphone can pick you up clearly. We sometimes also use the recordings in the preparation of an opinion. The lectern is also adjustable as to height by toggle switches on your right, one for up and one for down. If you find it uncomfortably high or uncomfortably low, by all means, reserve it. By all means, adjust it, which I was thinking about your reserving your time when I said that. For those of you who have electronic devices, iPhones, cell phones, Blackberries, Blueberries, and other things that may go bump in the night, please turn them off so as not to disturb counsel or the court in the course of the argument. And if there are no questions concerning these matters, we are ready to hear the appellant's argument in Vagnuer versus City of Aspen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I do want to mention that I think I'm the only Denver person here today. With me is Gary Wright, my co-counsel from Aspen. Your Honors, the issue before this court today, and there's really one issue, is whether the two alternative initiatives, which are at issue in this case, propose municipal legislation or ask the voters to perform an administrative act. There's a subsidiary issue as well, and that is, should the panel determine, and I think it is within the discretion of this panel to determine, that the measures are all or primarily legislative in nature, but there is an administrative component wandering around inside that measure somewhere. This court does have the discretion to strike that measure consistent not only with the severability clause of both initiatives themselves, but also with this court's opinion in the City of Colorado Springs v. Bull case and in accordance with that criteria. What both of these initiatives would do, and I know the panel is aware of this, is propose a new basic design concept for the transportation entry to the City of Aspen along Highway 82, which is a state highway going into the city. The only difference between these two measures is the provision in the second one, what we call the modified direct connection initiative for a cut and cover tunnel, which is part of the road going underground and preserving more open space. That is essentially the only difference.
Excuse me, counsel.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Laying aside the tunnel issue, I understand that.
Right.
Is there any difference between the proposals and the existing design other than changing two bus lanes to be HOV lanes?
The existing proposal, which comes out of the 1996 public vote, the series of 1996 resolution number 51, I believe, vote, is a two-lane highway. This is a four-lane highway that we are proposing. And the design criteria, the details of it, as set forth in the 1996 measure and our measure, are a bit different.
I understood that the 96 measure was amended somewhat by the 2007 measure.
It was, and I'm going to get in trouble right now on the facts, and I hope they're not terribly relevant here, but I understand that the amendment to the 1996 measure does not specifically affect the property that we're dealing with in this particular case. But the basic concept is different.
That raised my question. What is the rub here? I mean, why are the proponents wanting this passed particularly? And you said the affected property.
The proponents want this passed. Well, first off, the property itself is somewhat geographically dictated by where Highway 82 comes into Aspen. What the proponents are seeking to do in this case is break what the proponents view to be a logjam in the development of a currently proposed two-lane and light rail system coming into the city of Aspen, and instead provide for one or the other of these alternative proposals, which would provide for a four-lane entrance to Aspen from Highway 82.
So the proponents of the measures don't want the rail line, is that?
Both of our measures provide that provision for a future development of rapid transit, a rail line, should be accommodated by these measures. But okay, they aren't calling for it now because, frankly, they don't think the money is available now to do it. And the principal delay, we believe, or one of the reasons for the principal delay, has been the absence of financing for precisely that.
But what if the proposed measure said that the highway will be built out of concrete not less than 8 inches thick with rebar every 6 inches?
That
would be the difference between that and what, I mean, that's, I think, admittedly administrative.
That would be, there's a point, Your Honor, where it gets, I think, not only administrative but ridiculous if we propose a measure like that. And what I might do to answer that question.
I don't know whether to be offended by that or not, but
well, no.
You're certainly admitting,
I would offend myself.
You're certainly admitting that it's on this side. It's right. Over here, that's not an appropriate measure for an initiative.
That's right.
But what you're suggesting is that the design, the size, the potential use, be it buses or trains, is legislative.
Exactly, Your Honor. And let me go right to that point, if I may. The what the proponents have attempted to do with these two initiatives is do a little bit more than, say, run a road into Aspen, or run a four-lane highway off of 82 into Aspen and stop. What they've attempted to say is, what they've attempted to do is define the contours, the basic conceptual contours of what this transportation corridor would entail. In other words, it would involve, going through those nine paragraphs that appear in there, it would involve such things as the cut and cover tunnel in one context, and therefore provision of more open space. It would involve an accommodation for future light rail. It doesn't describe the engineering design of this future light rail, but it says we want to accommodate light rail in the future. It states, for example, one of the provisions was that lane access limitations should not be greater than they are down valley, which means, for example, if there's going to be an HOV lane, we're not saying there has to be, but if there's going to be an HOV lane, it can't require 15 people in the car and essentially morph into a bus lane. That discretion to design the intersections will be with the Colorado Department of Transportation, where they belong anyway, since this is a state highway. We're not designing the intersections, but we're saying that the discretion to do that should rest with CDOT.
Councilor, sorry to interrupt.
No,
I want to go back to the cut and cover tunnel piece of this. If that were approved, if this were to go forward and that were to be approved, they would have to do a cut and cover tunnel.
If the modified alternative were approved, a cut-and-cover tunnel. These provisions, by the way...
Just focus on that, because I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
This is where I'm getting confused.
I'm hesitating a little bit to say they would have to, because the operative language of these initiatives is that they authorize and approve these designs and rescind prior inconsistent authorizations and approval. Now, in a practical sense, that may mean, unless there is future legislation, they may have to do that
or
nothing.
Okay, let's say every traffic engineer that looks at this says that's not possible. Maybe what's underground or who knows what is not, all that's not possible. Doesn't that seem to encroach on administrative type issues here?
I don't think so, any more than such a post hoc determination like that would in itself make something non-legislative to begin with.
Now, I would disagree, because I think if it would say we authorize versus, that's where I got stuck on, it seems like they would have to do it this way versus authorize, where the executive agencies, the engineers, those types would come in and say this is not feasible.
If it is impossible to do, Your Honor, number one, I would suggest that is a very appropriate piece of information to bring forward in the legislative context before the people in this particular case as an initiative, and tell them.
Does that distinguish it between legislative?
I would submit respectfully, Your Honor, that it does not. And the reason it does not is what these measures do is authorize and approve a concept and repeal prior authorizations and enactments, in other words, legislative provisions, that propose a different design concept. Now, if it turns out, and is somehow missed in the context of the political campaign as well, that it is impossible to do this, then that's something that's going to have to be addressed at that time. We're not going to mandate that something be done that's impossible to be done. The result
maybe
of your question
you
is nothing would be
but
done.
But maybe you don't know until after the election.
Well, in that case, nothing would be done. And then the people would be presented, one would presume, or city council would be presented, one would presume in their legislative capacity, with the option of creating a new design to get around what we've now learned is an impossibility. And, Your Honor, I would go further, and you're asking the questions that go directly to the heart of this matter. What you're posing here, should that come to pass, is a consequence of passing this piece of, a possible consequence of the passage of what we believe to be a piece of legislation. As with, and I think we brief references in the briefs, as with consideration of title challenges and so forth in the context of the state initiative laws and so forth, it is not our job pre-adoption in a judicial as opposed to a political legislative context to adjudicate what will happen in the event of developments downstream, such as impossibility. I mean, these measures could be, and I don't think they are, unconstitutional for some reason, blatantly unconstitutional. In theory, I don't think they are, but they could be. In that case, there's a consequence later on that they could not be carried through. But that's not for today, and that's not the issue before this court.
What if, taking his question a step further, it's not a physical impossibility, it's a financial impossibility, or no rational public servant would spend that amount of money
then
on putting that tunnel in.
Then, well, first off, they should say that in the context of the legislative consideration. Secondly, if we're in a post-adoption context, this does not mandate by its plain language that it be done. It authorizes and approves that and rescinds prior authorizations and approvals that are inconsistent therewith. Now, the result may be somewhat consistent with the practicality of what's going on today, and is that it won't be done. Nothing will be done until another piece of legislation is passed proposing something that can.
But isn't that what the definition between legislative and administrative is sort of all about? I mean, if it's something that's going to require a chain of decisions down the road that you find out alternative A doesn't work, we'll try B, B doesn't work, we'll do C. But that means that down the road, we're going to have to do D and E, and we're going to have to change it here and there and yon. Isn't that exactly the kind of decision that is administrative and not legislative?
I would respectfully submit, Judge Roy, this is precisely the opposite. That legislation creates, is presenting a policy, a design concept. There are perhaps, and I don't know, we could argue this.
Do you know of any public projects that the design concept has been by a vote of the electorate?
Well, certainly. The, for example, the establishment, in terms of basic design, the establishment of the prisons in the state of Colorado. There is a statute, and you've caught me unable to cite it today, which is maybe good because I don't have it in my brief. But the locations and security levels and some basic requirements for perimeter protection of Colorado prisons is established in broad brush, not in detail, but in very broad brush in Colorado statute. I think it's Title 19.
But does that say for this particular prison, for this particular entrance to the prison, there shall be the following security requirements?
There is, as I recall, Your Honor, there's reference, for example, there will be electrified or concertina fence, barbed fences around the facilities, and that they will be designed to accommodate security levels at various levels in different locations.
That's an issue of general applicability of the entire prison system. They're not saying we're passing this law that says you're going to build this particular door for this particular prison.
And we aren't doing that here. I again would respectfully submit. We are saying in one of these measures that this involves a cut and cover tunnel. That's all we're saying, a cut and cover tunnel. Now, if there is a problem with the cut and cover tunnel, A, that should be brought out in the campaign, in the legislative process, and considered there. B, if later on it's determined to be impractical or impossible to have a cut and cover tunnel, the design details which are being totally left to the engineers and the design experts in the future, then all, again, we've done is authorize and approve it and eliminate other authorizations. That means the city is stuck much as it is today, and they're going to have to come up with another legislative proposal, which they're certainly capable of doing.
Assuming these initiatives don't get on the ballot or don't get adopted if they're on the ballot,
right.
Don't they still have the ability to go forward with a cut and cover tunnel?
I would submit that that's not authorized today. I would like to say, as my time is racing down.
You've got a minute. You may have it.
Okay. I will save that, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Whenever you're ready, sir. Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Corey Zerbaugh. I'm with the Aspen Law Firm of Klein, Cote & Edwards here for Appalese, Les Holtz, Clifford Weiss, and Terry Paulson. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of our time for counsel for the City of Aspen to make a presentation as well.
I will give you a high sign.
Okay, thank you, sir. This is my first time before you all. I came from West Virginia before practicing out here, so I'm happy to be here.
You've been in the appellate courts in West Virginia?
Only on paper. Never oral argument. Yeah, it's our position that counsel for appellants was correct, that there is one primary issue, and that's the legislative administrative analysis. It's our opinion that this matter really is akin to what the Colorado Supreme Court decided in the Idaho Springs v. Blackwell case. In that case, the facts of that case were the City of Idaho Springs City Council had decided they needed a new town hall, and the voters had approved a funding mechanism for that. And so the city administration went into work and picked a location, did the administrative analysis to determine what kind of building they were going to need, what the cheapest, most efficient way to do it was going to be. They found that there was an historical building in the area that would work. They were going to move it to this new site, place it on the site, and refurbish that building. That was the plan that was going to be put into place. Some citizens, some voters in the area decided they didn't like that plan. They didn't like the location, and they didn't like how they were going to make the building. And so they proposed a ballot initiative to basically dictate that the city couldn't put it on that piece of land and couldn't use the building they were going to use. So the Supreme Court said that's too far, that the public policy there, the issue of public policy was, do we need a new city hall? Yes or no, that's the public policy. We need a new city hall. Where it's going to go, what it's going to look like, how it's going to be built, those are administrative issues. That's exactly what we have here in this case. We refer to it in the office as the entrance to Aspen case. The public policy is, do we need a new entrance to Aspen? Yes or no? Great, yes, we need a new entrance to Aspen. Give it to City Council, let them go out and do all the work, which they did. All the environmental studies, all the Department of Transportation and Federal Highway Safety Administration procedure, the city administration, the city council went and did all that, and they came up with a plan.
Do you agree with Mr. Ramey that the city is still stuck with a two-lane light rail for the last few miles into the city?
Is the city stuck with that? I don't believe so, no. I think the administrators, if they wanted, could use their administrative authority and change that. I think that's the administrative process. If they took the bulldozers out there and found out that there was some giant rock deposit they couldn't afford to move and they still wanted to go through and for some reason they needed to narrow it or widen it, the administration could do that. I think that would be within their purview.
And is the right-of-way that's been granted to allow that?
The current right-of-way, Yara, I don't know the answer to that question specifically. I believe the right-of-way is for the use of a road, and then the details of what that road looks like I still think would be up to the administration.
I'll ask you the same question I asked your opposing counsel. What is the rub here? Is this an environmental issue about the tunnel or whatever, train versus buses, HOV lanes, or is it adversely impacting somebody beyond what they expected and they're now opposing it?
Well, I think there are several rubs at issue. One is the use of the open space altogether, the Meralt Park open space. There are certainly citizens in the community that would like to see that stay the same as it is now. There are also very motivated proponents of the light rail system who would love to see that. The bus system that we have now, some people think, you know, it's a capacity. It's standing room only a lot of the times. The buses break down. Some people think a train might be better. Other people like the bus system. So, you know, if you ask me what's at issue here, I think there are a lot of different people who have a lot of different issues with this. There are people who like it just the way it is because it does create congestion and does force people to take the public transit that's there. So, you know, to pin it down to one rub or say that there's one group for this, one group against it, I think it can't really be done.
Go ahead.
So here, like in Idaho Springs, we have the public policy. We want a new entrance to Aspen. We have the...
And when was that adopted? When was that policy you just articulated, when was that adopted?
I would say that for the first time back in probably before 1996, when the first entrance was designed, the administration, the city council, I believe went and started the process to design the new entrance. And once they had all the details together and had worked with CDOT and the Federal Highway Administration to come up with the plan, I think the city council could have then began implementing that plan. Instead, they used the power they have under the city charter to put basically administrative issues to the voter for approval. It was a politically expedient thing to do. They knew it was a hot topic. They wanted to tell people, we've done the work. We think this is the best entrance. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to be very disruptive. We have the power to do this, but we want to put it to the voters. And that's what they did with that initial election. I believe those were administrative items in that initial ballot, but the city council has the authority to put administrative items on the ballot where an initiative petitioner does not. And council for the city may have a better recollection of of how that process worked his time in the city goes back a lot further than mine. If you look at the ballot initiatives themselves, there are a lot of, although counsel for petitioners says this is just a concept, there are a lot of specifics, and there is language in here that I don't believe can be interpreted as any other thing other than a mandate. If you look at the summary on the first page, it says, the question is, shall the state of Colorado Department of Transportation be authorized to construct and operate and maintain a four-lane highway, and then goes into more detail. But that summary, as it says, shall the Colorado Department of Transportation be authorized to construct? It's completely bypassing the city council and going straight to granting permission to CDOT to come in and build this, if CDOT wants to build
it. CDOT can build it without the permission.
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Well, I'd be willing to bet.
I would think so, but that's not an issue I've researched. That sounds right. And then if you go to, after the whereas clauses, down to sort of the meat of the petition, the first heading paragraph says that you're granting a right-of-way easement to the state of Colorado Department of Transportation for the purposes set forth here and after, and for no other purposes. So to say that these are just suggestions that can be modified on the fly, I think, is not accurate. This is saying it's for these purposes and for no other purposes. If you take, for instance, the cut and cover version of it, it limits the cut and cover to no less than 400 feet. Well, let's say they go to build this road and the engineers get out there, and for whatever reason, the geology dictates that the cut and cover can only be 375 feet or 350 feet. Well, the right-of-way says it has to be at least 400 feet or greater. You can't build one that's 350 feet, and there's no discretion in this. So what do? Do you go back to the voters? Do you go back to Mr. Evans and ask him what he thinks?
You come back and ask us what we think.
Exactly. But I think that's a clear indication that this is delving deeply into the administrative realm and outside of the legislative realm. There are many details. A four-lane, as opposed to any other configuration, is a detail that may or may not need to be made on the fly during construction, given financial and geologic considerations. There may be money to build a two-lane road now, but not a four-lane road. Can they start it? Can they build the two-lane and then wait till there's more money for the four-lane? Not according to this. They'd have to go back to the voters again. I mean, if this were to be adopted, you may have an endless procedure of going back and forth every year to tweak this road. It would take 100 years to get this thing built. And that's why it's administrative.
And would all of those changes have to be approved both by CDOT and the FHA as well?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you if the town's billing it, you have to get the approval of CDOT and the FHA.
Well, the town has already entered into a contract with both of those entities with respect to this project, have they not?
That's right, and there was a very expensive, very detailed federal environmental impact study that was done to get the Federal Highway Administration approvals for it. That would have to be redone because this is proposing a different road. So to answer your question, yes. I mean, if this were passed, that procedure would have to be conducted all over again. And at the initial hearing, Randy Reedy and Bud Ayers both testified at length about what that process is like and what would have to happen again if this were passed. So there's a good question as to whether or not, even if this were passed, whether it would pass any of
those. But the city did that on its own, did it? I mean, the city passed, submitted a bunch of things to the people that were administrative in nature. Are they bound by the vote of what the people said in that initiative?
I don't believe they're bound by it. I think they
well,
can.
Why would they be bound by it here?
Because
if this is administrative, why would they be bound by it here?
I'm not sure I understand your question. You're saying
my question was, you said the city put to the voters a proposal. That was a general outline of a project. It wasn't detailed. It wasn't engineered. It wasn't funded. It wasn't. It just went for some guidance. Shall we do this? And these are sort of what we're thinking about. And the voters passed it. Are they bound by what was in that initiative in 94 or 96, whenever it was?
Are they bound?
Answer the question, and I'll ask to stop the clock. Answer the question, and then your co-counsel has the rest of the time.
I believe they are bound by it to the extent that the right-of-ways are conditioned upon I'd have to look at the previous ballot initiative to tell you, but to the extent that there were conditions on the right-of-way that was approved by the people, then they may be bound by that. I would add that initiative, that ballot measure was put to the people after the approvals of CDOT and the FHA and the environmental impact study and everything had already been done. And so they knew they could go forward with it.
Okay. You want to let your co-counsel have the remaining 2+ minutes?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, my name is John Worcester. I'm the city attorney for the city of Aspen. I represent Catherine Cook in her official capacity as the city clerk for the city of Aspen. I also represent Karen Goldman in her official capacity as a hearing officer who presided over the hearing of the protest in this case. I asked Mr. Zurbach to reserve a few minutes of his time so that I could highlight for you the two major objections the city has to the two proposed initiative ordinances that are being proposed by the petitioners. The first is that the proposed ordinances, if either is approved by the electors, would mandate or require the city council to convey property to the Colorado Department of Transportation and allow them to construct a 4-lane highway on city open space. Second, if either ordinance is approved, years of work and millions of dollars of money spent on administrative matters that got us to this point today would be rescinded, including legally binding contracts that the city has with the Colorado Department of Transportation. The decision to construct a 4-lane highway on city-owned open space is an administrative matter. It is not legislative. With respect to the first objection, the mandatory nature of the ordinances, as Mr. Zurbach pointed out, the summary of the petitions of the petitioner's own proposed ordinances state as follows. Shall the state of Colorado Department of Transportation be authorized to construct, operate, and maintain a 4-lane highway on city open space? These summaries.
Mr. Could I just ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Assuming one of these proposals were to pass.
Yes, sir.
And CDOT said, we're not interested now. We're just going to keep doing what we've been doing. What would happen?
Nothing.
The whole project would just come to a halt?
It'd just come to a halt. I mean, there's nothing in these ordinances that would require CDOT to do anything. It would give them all the legal authority they need in order to construct the 4-lane highway. But it doesn't mandate that they do anything. What it does do is mandate that City Council grant to CDOT whatever rights of ways or permits or permission that they would need in order to construct the 4-lane highway.
So the city owns the land over which this highway is going to be
built? The city owns the land. It's open space. It's dedicated open space. And our city charter says that you cannot change the use of open space unless you obtain the approval of the voters. That's the legislative policy decision that has to be made in this case. The voters decide if and when open space is going to be changed for any use, much less a 4-lane highway. Everything after that is administrative in furtherance of that policy decision that we are going to change the use of our open space.
Now you're on our clock, and I just want to ask you one question. The original 94 or 96 proposal, did it require less land to be used than what's being proposed here? Was the right-of-way smaller?
Probably not, Your Honor, because the 96 vote authorized City Council to give to CDOT to convey to them a right-of-way for a 2-lane parkway and a corridor for light rail transportation system in the future. So that's probably about 4 lanes that they're talking about in their proposal.
Okay. So it's not, it's a maybe a slightly different use, but doesn't require materially more open space.
That's correct.
I think you're out of time, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. You have 54 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Two quick statements and all I have time for. Number one, Mr. Zurbuck and Mr. Worcester may be absolutely correct that these are horrible ideas, absolutely horrible ideas that will grind the world to a halt and the voters should not approve it. That is what the legislative process is about. That does not go to the question about whether this is legislative or not or administrative. Secondly, I would point the court again to the operative language of the initiative, which really falls right under the now therefore paragraph in both initiatives. So it says that these initiatives authorize and approve actions going forward, which would clearly themselves be administrative in nature in accordance with these particular design concepts. They do not mandate anything, and in fact, if they're impossible to perform, it may grind to a halt. Finally, I would just implore the court not to constrain legislation to such a level of generality that all we can say is put a four-lane highway in there and say nothing more about the concept that we're envisioning. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We thank all counsel for their briefs and arguments. A written opinion will issue in due course on the matter. The court will be in recess subject to call, and the bailiff may so announce.
All rise. The court will be in recess subject to call.